Welcome to Urban Dharma, the podcast, where suffering is optional. Hi, this is Reverend Kusa coming to you from downtown Los Angeles, from the International Buddhist Meditation Center in the heart of Koreatown. It's another cool and overcast day in Southern California, but the podcast you're about to hear is one I gave at Chadwick School a couple days ago to the second class studying the book Siddhartha. The teacher asked if I'd speak to the second class as well and speak about Buddhism and perhaps give them a better idea of what Siddhartha meant. The class needed to do an essay. So this is that presentation. This is my presentation to the second class at Chadwick School studying the book Siddhartha. So
if I speak right now, I could hear myself.
You could. Let's reduce again.
Can I speak right now?
What's up, iTunes?
There we go. Okay. I like that. Might be a good way to start the podcast. So, you're studying, you read the book Siddhartha? Are you reading the book Siddhartha? You read it, finished the book, and confusing? Made perfect sense? Why did he get enlightened? Did he need a teacher? If you're enlightened, are you always supposed to have a teacher, or can you be enlightened without a teacher? I noticed that was up there. So, let me talk a little bit about that. In early Buddhism, they have four different levels. There's the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and then the fully enlightened person. You also have the Buddha. The Buddha did not learn from a teacher. The Buddha rediscovered the path to nirvana or enlightenment. The reason I say rediscovered is because Siddhartha was the 28th Buddha according to early Buddhist tradition. The 29th Buddha will be Maitreya Buddha, and he's in heaven right now, waiting to come down as soon as the last person who knows the teachings of this Buddha dies. So far, this Buddhism has been alive for over 2,500 years. We're not sure when the last person will die, but I got a feeling as long as there are podcasts, Buddhism will be okay. There is something called a silent Buddha in Buddhism. A silent Buddha in Buddhism is someone, could be anybody, Christian, Jew, Muslim, atheist, Baha'i, whatever you want to call it, who becomes enlightened, doesn't know how he did it, doesn't know how she did it, simply becomes enlightened. No teacher, no training, no understanding. So we have that category. We have the category of the Arahant. The Arahant in early Buddhism listens to the teacher, does the practice, and achieves nirvana. We have the tradition in Mahayana Buddhism, later Buddhism, of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is one who doesn't necessarily want to listen to the teachings of the Buddha, but wants to do what the Buddha did, not what he said. So we have a lot of different kinds of Buddhism. In the same way, if you've studied Christianity, there are tons of Christians, and they're all different. They all seem to have one teacher, though, Christ, huh? And all the kinds of Buddhism we have had one teacher, and that was the Buddha. But then Christ died, and then the Buddha died. And then, in Buddhism's case, all the monks got together and said, well, what did the Buddha really mean? And he was dead and couldn't answer them. So they said, well, he really meant this. So a new kind of Buddhism came up into the world. Or he really meant this. And then another kind of Buddhism came up in the world. And when I look at the Christians, there's differences, but not a lot of differences. And when I look at the Buddhists, there are differences, but not a lot of differences. You know? So it's sort of interesting how that works. Can we find wisdom within? You know, as a Buddhist, we feel we are already perfect. We feel we already have as much love as we'll ever need. The only thing we have to do is get rid of lust. We already have as much generosity as we'll ever need. All we need to do is get rid of greed. We already have as much love and kindness as we'll ever need. All we need to do is get rid of hatred and anger. We already have as much wisdom as we'll ever need. All we need to do is get rid of ignorance and delusion. In Buddhism, our path is to get rid of the things that prevent us from our own perfection. So we already are enlightened, according to Buddhism. It's just we have lust, greed, hatred, and delusion blocking us from that enlightenment. Isn't that a cool message that we're already perfect? Now, I like that message, but sometimes if you're from another religion, it feels a little uncomfortable because there's this thing called sin, and there might be this thing called original sin. And some people have asked me, well, do Buddhists have original sin? And I say, no, we don't. We have original ignorance. We're born stupid. We do dumb things, and that's why we suffer. Our job as a Buddhist is not to find God. Our job as a Buddhist is to end suffering. If somebody comes to me and says, I really want to find the path to God, I say, please check with the Christians, Jews, and Muslims. They have that path. If somebody comes to me and says, I want to end my suffering, I say, please sit down. I have something to share. The Buddha, in his time, believed in the gods of India. He believed that the gods of India created the world, made the crops grow, made the rain fall. But then one day he went into the streets of the city and he saw this really old guy. He saw this really sick guy. He saw this really dead guy. And he saw this really religious guy. And he woke up to the fact that our life is really difficult. That because we're born, we have to get old, we have to get sick, and we have to die. None of us gets out of life alive. Man. Now I imagine the future Buddha, Siddhartha, going to a small hill on a full moon night and petitioning all the gods of India to step forward and end human suffering. I imagine him saying, please, you're the ones who are responsible for us being here. You've given us life. Can't you end human suffering? Do we all have to suffer in these terrible ways? Can't you intervene? And not one of the gods in India stepped forward to end human suffering. And I imagine the Buddha at that moment saying, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to end my suffering, and then I'm going to tell everybody how I did it. But he had one more really important thing to do before he did that. He needed to have a kid. He needed to have an heir to the throne because he was a prince and his dad was a king. So finally, at the age of 29, he had his first child, a boy. He named him Rahula. Rahula means fetter or impediment. Now, I don't know many new dads that would name their firstborn a fetter or impediment, but in the story of the Buddha, it works well. On the very night he was born, he kissed his wife and new son goodbye, left them in the care of his parents, took a horse, went to the edge of the forest, cut off all his hair, took off all his princely clothes and jewelry, tossed them aside, picked up these old rags that were lying next to his feet on this path he was standing on, tied them together, covered his naked body, and for the next 6 years, he practiced renunciation, asceticism, and meditation. He wanted to see where suffering came from, so he took everything that made him comfortable and pushed it out of his life. It's said that he would not lie down at night to go to sleep. He would sleep sitting in full lotus posture every night. It said he only had one meal a day. It said during the summer months, the hottest days, he'd build four fires in each of the major directions. He would sit between those fires and he would just sweat and feel so uncomfortable. He wanted to see where suffering came from. And when he figured out where it came from, he thought he had a chance at putting an end to it. Now, when I first read this story, I thought it was just a legend and didn't really exist, and people don't really do that kind of stuff anyway. And you know what? They do. They do. There is a Chinese Buddhist temple right now in Northern California called the Sagely City of 10,000 Buddhas. And if you become a monk or nun at that temple, you are not allowed to lie down at night to go to sleep. You have to sleep sitting up in full lotus posture. You only get one meal a day, and it's vegetarian. And I went up there. I got to lay down. But I went up there, and you know what I noticed about all those monks and nuns? Every one of them was really tired. They're not getting enough sleep. They are working so hard on finding out where suffering comes from. They have created a lifestyle that's conducive to suffering. That's what the Buddha did. And at the end of 6 years, he was 99% of the way to his perfection. He had almost achieved nirvana. One more percent to go, couldn't figure out how to do it. None of the teachers in India at that time were enlightened or had achieved nirvana. So he made a vow to himself to sit beneath the tree, later became called the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. And it said, according to the early Buddhist tradition that comes from Sri Lanka, he sat there for 7 days and seven nights. And at the end of those 7 days and seven nights, he became a perfect human being. He never had to suffer again, and he never had to be reborn again. Now, that might sound weird, huh? Not to be reborn again? What does that have to do with anything? But isn't the reason we're suffering because we were born? And wouldn't it be cool if we could exist without birth? And none of us have a clue how that might be, because everything in this world was created. Everything. There was not one thing now in this world that is here because it wasn't created. Now, I don't go into why it's created or who. Some people think intelligent design. Some people think God. Some people think evolution and the Big Bang theory. Some people think the flying spaghetti monster. I'm not sure why, but we're here because of birth. Everything in this world is here because it was created. And because it was created, it has to die. The Buddha, on the other hand, is now living right now, right here with us. You can't see him, you can't hear him, you can't smell him, can't taste him, can't touch him, can't even think about him, because he is living not because of birth or creation, he is living because of his nirvana. Nirvana is unborn. He exists right now because he's not born. Is that far out? Wow. So as a Buddhist, when we achieve nirvana, not only do we end our suffering, we end all future rebirths, which takes away the idea of having to ever suffer again. Now people say to me, well, Kusala, why are you here? Why were you born? And I say, well, I was born because my parents had sex and I had karma. And those two things came together, and out I came. But as a Buddhist, if I can end my karma in nirvana, I'll never have to be reborn again. So Buddhism, in a very real way, is all about karma. It's about ending your karma, and in the first place, it's about changing your karma. Has anybody ever seen that TV show, My Name is Earl?
Yeah.
Isn't that the best show?
That's pretty funny.
I like that show. Well, if you ever get a chance to see it, it's all about karma. And he's changing his karma. He has a list of things he needs to change. People he was unkind to, things he did that caused a lot of suffering. And in each episode, he takes his list out and he changes some of his karma. So what is karma? Karma is everything we think, everything we say, and everything we do. Karma always has a consequence. When we say something skillful, people are happy. When we say something unskillful, people aren't so happy. When we think skillful thoughts, we're happy. When we think unskillful thoughts, we're unhappy. When we do skillful activities, people and us, ourselves, we're happy. And then when we do unskillful activities, they're unhappy. So you're probably wondering, well, what's an unskillful activity? What's an unskillful thought? What's an unskillful speech? Something that's based in lust, greed, hatred, and delusion. That's always unskillful. Skillful, love, generosity, compassion, and wisdom. Now let me give you an example of an unskillful thought. Just the other night, I found myself in Ralph's supermarket. And there I was, standing, minding my own business on the bakery aisle. And in front of me was a large stack of Entenmann's chocolate cakes, the ones with the cream filling in the frosting. And I said to myself, I'm buying two, one for tonight and one for tomorrow. And then I stopped and said, that's an unskillful thought. That's a greedy thought. If I was being generous, I'd be buying two, one for me, one for you. So see how that mind works? Greed, generosity. We want to change our karma. We do that in two ways. We follow the precepts and we practice meditation. What are the precepts? The five precepts are to avoid taking life, to avoid taking what is not given, to avoid sexual misconduct, to avoid lying, to avoid consuming intoxicants. Those five precepts allow us to change what we say and what we do. Then we practice meditation. Meditation allows us to change how we think. What is karma? Karma is everything we think, everything we say, everything we do. The practice of Buddhism is designed to change our karma and in nirvana, end our karma. How cool is that? So how do you practice not taking life? I say, start big. When you wake up in the morning, say to yourself, I'm not killing any human beings today. And then go out into the world. Most of us will make it. Okay. So then, after you get good at not killing human beings, say to yourself, I'm not killing any lions, tigers, or bears today either. And you go out into the world. Most of us can do that too. Now it gets difficult, though, when we get to mosquitoes, cockroaches, and flies. Most of us can't do that. So we start big. Not to take anything that is not given. I'm going to start big today. I'm not going to take $1 million from anybody today. Make it through the whole day, not take $1 million. But how about not take a pencil that's on the desk that was left behind when you need a pencil? That's difficult. You know? And how about intoxication? Now, I am the Buddhist chaplain at UCLA. We have a Buddhist club that meets every Tuesday. And sometimes the UCLA students like to have a little beer once in a while. I mean, it's tough. They're studying hard. They got a party going on. Somebody offers you a beer. Is it okay to drink? Well, according to Buddhism, it's okay to drink if you don't get drunk. One of my favorite songs was, I ain't drunk, I just been drinking. It's an old blues song. And when you get really good at not getting drunk, then you can say to yourself, well, why should I drink at all? Maybe I could drink some iced tea or Coca-Cola. So we start big, and then we go to the hard part, which is a small part. Then we start our meditation practice, two kinds of Buddhist meditation, insight meditation, tranquility meditation. The Buddha did both. And we start transforming the way we perceive the world around us. We start to see the real present moment experience of our life in a brand new way. We start to let go of past and future. We start to be more concerned about what we're doing right now rather than what we're going to do tomorrow. And eventually, we come to a place where we don't have to suffer. Now, let me give you a definition of suffering that really works well for me. I was giving a presentation in Glendale, California, to a bunch of seventh graders. And in the audience was Esmeralda. And Esmeralda raised her hand after my presentation and said, Reverend Kusala, I now understand the difference between pain and suffering. Suffering is when you don't want to have the pain. How does she know that? Gosh. And that's what the Buddha is talking about. If you got a Honda and want a Ford, you're going to suffer. If you got a girlfriend and don't want one, you're going to suffer. If you don't have a girlfriend and want one, you're going to suffer. How can I come to a place of acceptance with the way things are? And if I can figure out how to do that, I won't have to suffer. And the Buddhist path is all about seeing the perfection in every present moment. Anybody got any questions? About stuff? Yes.
How can you tell if someone's like enlightened?
What are the characteristics of a person who's enlightened? Is that it? Let me tell you. I'll tell you what they are. You don't have to answer that. I'm going to tell you. Number one, their only intention, the only thoughts in their mind are ones of loving kindness. Their only activity is compassionate activity that reduces the suffering of others. Their only happiness, their only success is based on the happiness and success of others. And their mind is always in a perfect state of balance, equanimity, choiceless awareness. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. Those are four of the characteristics of an enlightened person. Does that make sense, Soda?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the question. Yes?
Well, in the book it says that, like, that one of the overall themes is that you can't follow someone else's path in order to reach enlightenment. So, well, isn't that, aren't you following someone else's path by, you know, doing the same kind of meditations and doing the same things that they did in order to reach enlightenment?
Yeah, we're doing the same things they did, but in our own way. Because the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, never rode a motorcycle in his life. I rode a motorcycle, I ride one every day. So I got to do it my way. He lets me know how he did it. The suttas, the stories and the texts in Buddhism are how he did it. And then we look at that and say, okay, this is how I'm going to do it. I live in downtown Los Angeles, in Koreatown. I'm going to have to do it a little differently than somebody who lives in San Fernando Valley, because they got a whole different set of conditions and circumstances. So we use him as a reference, and then we figure out how to do it ourselves in our own special way. So you're right. You can't do anybody else's life. You have to do your own life, but you can use people as teachers. Now, I have come to understand that there are two kinds of teachers in the world. The first kind of teacher tells you how to do it. The second kind of teacher shows you what not to do. The second kind of teacher, there's plenty of them in the world. So we can look any place we go, we can look at anybody in the room and say, okay, I want to do that, I don't want to do that. But then we have to do it in our own way. Isn't that cool? You know, it's like somebody who wants to be, like I play guitar every day, and I love the blues guitar. And I hear people play the blues guitar, and I hear people like Stevie Ray Vaughan, he's dead now, but he's got some good stuff out, and he closed his eyes, and he could play every note in the world, and it just sounded so good. And I close my eyes, and I can't play anything. And I'm going, I'll never be able to play like Stevie Ray Vaughan. And then I go, but I need to learn how to play like I'm going to play. He can teach me some techniques and some riffs, in some chord progressions and note progressions, but then I have to figure out how to make it mine. And that's when you find your voice. That's when you find your authenticity. So we encourage everybody to be authentic. Each one of us has different karma and a different life, and that can be our raft to nirvana or enlightenment. Thanks for the question. Yes? No, actually I didn't. I was born a Lutheran, and my parents were very happy to be Lutheran, and I was happy to be Lutheran until I got into high school. And when I went into high school, it was in the 60s, and it was very important to question all authority and not trust anyone over 30. So I became an agnostic. I didn't trust anybody. And I thought there might be a God, but I wasn't sure what to call it, so I just said, okay. But you know what happened? I turned 30. I became the other side now. And I had just watched a movie called Logan's Run, available on DVD. And in that movie, there's a little gem in your palm, and when you turn 30, it starts to blink, and they come and find you, and then they kill you. So I went through a very traumatic experience. I'm thinking, I'm 30 now. I'll be dead soon. I got to find a religion. So I bought a book called The World Religions by Houston Smith, and I read all the chapters in the book. And I stopped and reread the chapter on Buddhism. And I said, oh, that's it. That's the religion I want to be. And then I got another book, the phone book. And I found a meditation center. And I started to meditate. So I found my religion in a very practical way. I didn't want to die without a religion. And I read a book to find one. I'm not advocating that for everybody. But so far, it's worked for me. And I'm still not dead. Cool. You know? Yes?
Are you married now?
Okay. No.
Okay. And is it okay to get married?
Not if you're a Buddhist monk. And what's wrong with marriage?
Well, I know you said you're trying to get rid of lust, but don't you think there's a difference between lust and love?
Oh, there is. Can I tell you a story?
Yes.
Thanks for bringing it up. A couple years ago, I was invited to go to the first Monks in the West Conference. Catholic monks and Buddhist monks came together to talk about inner life and training. And we're all celibate. bunch of old guys who are celibate. And what's the first thing we start talking about? Sex. But we start talking about how not to have sex, because that's what monks talk about. Hey, I got a real good way of how not to have sex. And we share these good ways with each other. And then I'm thinking, as I'm listening to all these old guys, how are we supposed to love if we can't have sex? Because most people love and have sex and it works together. Lust and love, right? And is there a difference between lust and love? And why is lust so bad and love so good? So I'm thinking about all this stuff. Man. Then I thought back in my life, and I said, has there ever been a man in my life who told me how to love? Has there ever been just one man in my life that told me how to love as a man? And I had to come to the conclusion that not one man in my whole life ever told me how to love. They only told me how to lust. What kind of shoes to wear, how to comb my hair, what to say, where to take the date. That's not love. That's lust. So how do men love? I said to myself. How am I, as a monastic man, supposed to love another human being? And I'm supposed to love everybody, aren't I? Men and women. Dogs and cats. And did the Buddha love everybody? You know, when I thought about the Buddha, I didn't think he loved everybody. I know Christ loved everybody, because they always talk about Christ loving everybody. But the Buddha came from a warrior caste. You know, he learned how to do, you know, bows and arrows and throw spears, and he learned how to run a kingdom, and he was like a tough guy, and he suffered for years, and he finally achieved enlightenment. He doesn't sound like the kind of guy that you want to tell a joke to. Or put your arm around and say, hey, how's it going, man? Doesn't sound like that kind of guy at all. So did the Buddha really love anybody? Or did he just have indifference and not care? So I'm thinking about this, and first thing I have to do is I have to figure out what love is. What is love to a man? And more importantly, what is love to a monastic man? And this is what I came up with. When a man truly loves another human being, they accept them exactly the way they are. That's it. It might not sound like much, but have you ever been in the presence of someone who's accepted you exactly the way you are? How comfortable does that feel? You don't have to pretend to be anything else than just who you are and what you do. And you can say anything and it won't make that person feel uncomfortable, because they are accepting you exactly the way you are. And it doesn't matter about gender, does it? You can be a guy and accept another guy exactly the way they are, and accept a girl exactly the way she is. So that would be love in Buddhism. But now I'm thinking, if you love somebody like that, how do you express it? What do you do? How do you show your love? And if the Buddha loved everybody like that, how did he show his love? And then it came to me. When a person is truly in love that way, they are always kind to the person they love. How about that? Have you ever been on a date and your date's not kind to you, and yet they say they love you? No. But if you love me, why can't you be kind to me? So I think the Buddha did love everybody. I think the Buddha accepted everybody just the way they were. And I think he showed his love through kindness. And as a monk, if I were to have an intimate relationship with someone, I would be showing preference. And because I'm celibate, I can love everybody, theoretically, accept everybody exactly the way they are, and express it through kindness, and never have to show a preference. So it really works well for monastics not to have sex. It gives them a lot more time, and most of them don't have much money anyway, so what kind of dates are you going to go on? And we live in an economy of generosity. We live on donations from people. Can you imagine if I had a girlfriend, and people want to give me a donation after meditation, and I said to them, can you put a few more dollars in the kitty, because I want to take her out to a movie tonight? It wouldn't work very well, would it? So, because I'm not married, because I don't have children, because I can stay out all night if I have to, in a hospital with someone dying, I have flexibility and freedom that people who are married, committed relationships, children, mortgages, car payments, 9-to-5 jobs don't have. And that lifestyle, I find, allows me to be of service to others as well as practice and study myself. So I hope that made sense. Did that sort of make sense? Because a lot of people think that we are suffering. And we are. I had a person, I was at a conference in Boston, Massachusetts. And this woman stands up and says, well, how do you guys feel about homosexuality? And I said, well, you know, it's really just another way to suffer. Because if you're straight, you're going to suffer. If you're gay, you're going to suffer. And if you're celibate, you're going to suffer. But we all suffer in our own way. I had a Lutheran pastor come up to me and say, it must be really hard to be celibate. And I said to him, it must be really hard to be married. And he smiled. So you see, there's so much emphasis put on this part of our life. And actually, if we can keep our life simple, our life is much fuller. But the drama, we all like drama, don't we? Don't we like the drama? You know, it just makes life so much more interesting to have this roller coaster ride. Oh, he loves me, she loves me, he doesn't, they hate me, I don't know what I'm going to do, how can I live, da, da, da. And that's the story of our life and all the stories we hear from people. And as a Buddhist monk, we want those stories to sort of get pushed aside and just come and look at people and say, how can I help? And if I can't help, then I have to leave. And so we leave. And then somebody says, oh, I'm suffering now. Can you come and help? Sure. I'll stop there.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Yeah, a couple of very quick questions.
Okay.
Can we talk about the interconnectedness of all things
briefly? Okay.
The meaning of life.
Yeah, you know, as a Buddhist, the meaning of life is a tough one. I think it's more about the doing of life than the meaning of life. So we want to do a lot of stuff, and the meaning sort of takes care of itself. Interconnectedness. Interdependence. This is a really interesting topic. Anybody read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
Oh.
Yeah.
I saw the book, but I've never read it.
Okay, it's a cool book. It's available in audio, which you can download into your iPod and take it with you wherever you go. But in this book, the guy has a Honda and his buddy has a BMW. And his buddy always felt the BMW had more quality because it was German engineered. Now, what I imagine for this book would be they both take the motorcycles out to a Kmart parking lot and take them apart into their 10,000 pieces and say to them, find me the quality of your motorcycle. I'm going to give you this magnifying glass. Look at each piece. Tell me where the quality of your motorcycle lives. And then I picture them in my mind going out, looking at each piece of the motorcycle, and coming back empty-handed. I can't find the quality. And yet somehow when all the pieces come together and create one, quality arises. So quality seems to be connected to oneness. Self, ego, soul seems to be connected to oneness. In Buddhism, the ultimate reality is unity. The relative reality is diversity. What we would say is that the illusion of one is created by self and ego. If you have a car, it's a Honda, and in order to describe that car to your friends, you'd have to tell them what each piece was called. It would take you a whole day, if not longer. But we can take one word with four letters, and we can have a car. Or if your name is Mary, or Susie, or George, or Carlos, that one word describes all your characteristics without having to list them separately. That's how we sort of look at the world. We don't see the unity in the world. We see the separateness of the world. Our ego creates separateness for us so we can understand it and so we can use it. If I'm on my motorcycle and I'm on the 405 freeway and I'm doing 70 miles an hour, I don't want to be one with the car next to me. I want to be separate. If a police officer comes up to me because I'm going 75 and wants to give me a ticket and I take out my license and say, you know, this really isn't who I am. This just describes my many parts that are interconnected and interdependent. He might say, Kusala, have you ever thought about counseling? Because I think you're coming at it in a strange way. So as a Buddhist, we want to dance in the relative and the ultimate. Relative allows for diversity. Ultimate allows for unity. But it never becomes one thing. It always becomes many things that are connected. Yeah?
Would you consider Buddhism a philosophy or a religion? And how would you describe it? Because I'm kind of confused on that. I don't see a lot of dependence on God and Buddhism as I do in other religions.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, good question. You know, for 5 years I was a volunteer at Central Juvenile Hall in downtown Los Angeles. And for a while I was going into the classrooms there speaking about Buddhism. And because it's state-run and because we're not supposed to have church and state together, I remember one time there was this woman. She was an older woman. She was the teacher. And I walked in and she said, "Kusala, you can't speak about God here." And I said, "No problem." And I spoke for the whole hour and didn't mention her name once. So, do Buddhists believe in God? Some do, but not because of Buddhism. Are there some Buddhists that don't believe in God? Yes, but not because of Buddhism. Are there some Buddhists that don't know? Quite a few, and that probably is because of Buddhism. See, we have our niche, our place. We say life is unsatisfactory, but we can change it. Pain happens, suffering is optional. It's a religion because there is salvation in it, salvation from suffering. Most people I know in the West, Westerners, Americans, and others who come to Buddhism, look at it more of as a philosophy. It's a way to live your life. It's a way to be happy. It's a way not to be sad. And that's fine, but if Buddhism does what it's supposed to do, it eventually becomes a religion to them too. I just went up to Big Sur. Anybody know where Big Sur is? Northern California? Anybody been up there? Well, I took my motorcycle to Big Sur and did a wedding at Ventana, a cool inn overlooking the ocean. And they wanted to have a Buddhist wedding. Okay. So we did. They looked at Buddhism as being religious, you know, but it was also a philosophy for them too. None of their parents were Buddhist, you know, so it was interesting for me to show up and the family, you know, and they said, "Hi, Kusala, you know, are you a vegetarian, Kusala? We're going to have meat tonight." I say, "Oh no, I eat anything. Fine with me." So Buddhism can be a religion, it can be a philosophy, it can be simply the way you live your life. It has all those possibilities. Yeah?
I have a question. Like, you know how the Buddha said that humans were, like, born before, like, perfect or enlightened? Like, how can that, like, be if, like, aren't humans, like, born with, like, isn't that natural for them to have, like, lust, greed, rather than, like, human emotions?
Yeah. Yeah, and those are there not because of sin, but because of ignorance. We have lust because of ignorance. We think... Now, you know, again, talking about the celibacy thing, you know, some people think that if you have enough sex, you'll end your desire for sex. You know? So they're out trying to have as much sex as they can have. They figure if they can have sex at least 1,000 times, they'll never have to have sex again. Never stops. That desire always continues. So we would look at lust as being unsatisfactory because it creates desire and can't be satisfied. But we would look at love as being satisfactory because that doesn't create desire. So we are not enlightened because of ignorance. And we don't see the world the way it really is. If you've ever watched the movie Matrix, anybody watch Matrix? Hey, it was all about waking up, wasn't it? Remember when Neo woke up? And he went, "Oh, man." And then he just like started to throw up because there was so much reality he couldn't quite, and then he gradually went into it. Well, that's sort of like what enlightenment is you slowly, slowly wake up through your practice, and then you see reality exactly the way it is. You know, and imagine, and please don't take offense to this, I can use men too, but imagine you're in love with this beautiful girlfriend, and she's like 17, and she's just shapely and beautiful, and no blemishes, and just perfect person. And then imagine her at 90. You go, what happened? And then, of course, look at yourself. Now you're strong and healthy, you know, have a lot of hair, and then you're 90. And you don't have any hair, and your teeth all fell out. And you go, damn. So with this kind of reality, would you attach yourself to something that's impermanent? Would you attach yourself and cling and hold on to something that can't be yours? Because ownership is an illusion. And when you start to wake up, you start to see the world in a much different way. So there's a lightness. In the same way the river keeps moving, you look at your life as always manifesting in a new way every moment. And you're not bummed out. It's sort of exciting because you don't know what's going to happen next. It's always magical. So I hope that answered your question, and I added some other stuff too. Okay. Yeah.
I probably am missing a part of this, but can you explain how I feel like Buddhism doesn't encourage like self, like willpower and like determination and like striving for something, like even if it's like I really want to like win the
game, get good grades, go to college, get a great job, find the right guy,
yeah,
buy a new car,
yeah,
all that kind of
just
stuff.
Just like traits like that, like willpower and like having a strong like character.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all about self and having a healthy ego. And so if somebody wanted that, we would recommend a psychologist or psychiatrist, because their job is to have a healthy ego. You know, and so you, and in our highly competitive culture, society, it's important to have goals, and it's important to meet those. And the Buddhist would say, well, you're always in a state of becoming, and you never become anything. It never reaches fruition. It's always a process. And even if you get that one thing that you really wanted, you've worked your whole life for, is that going to make you ultimately happy and satisfied? Or are you simply looking at other things now for that happiness? So a Buddhist would say, if you want happiness, it can't be dependent on anything that's going to change. Because as soon as it changes, you'll be unhappy. So we want to be happy because of nirvana, because nirvana is unborn and doesn't change. The only thing in this world that doesn't. And so there are a lot of Buddhists who are very successful. I was giving a talk at USC to a bunch of business majors. And one of the guys said, if you're a Buddhist, is it okay to make a lot of money? Because it doesn't sound like you're supposed to make a lot of money. And I said, oh yes, make as much money as you can, because then you can give more away. How cool is that, to be rich and give it away? You know? So it's not about having the stuff. It's not about having the goals. It's about being attached to it. As soon as you cling to it, you're going to suffer. Okay. Harmonica. You know, I've been talking about suffering, and I brought my blues harmonica with me today, because it always makes me feel better when I play it. And maybe if you're suffering now, you'll suffer less because of what I've just said. And when you think about the blues, what else would a Buddhist want to play, huh? So here we go. A little blues harmonica. Yeah. that's it. That was my presentation to the second class at Chadwick School, who was studying the book Siddhartha. And I hope you found it interesting. Hope you found it useful. If you'd like to know more about me, please visit my website, kusala.info, kusala.info. I have a newsletter I send out twice a month, and if you're interested in receiving it, please go to urbandharma.org and sign up. My email address is kusala@urbandharma.org, and I'm always happy to hear from everybody, and I'll get back with you just as soon as I can. So until the next time, until the next podcast, be happy, be peaceful, and most of all, be free from suffering.